If there's a bit of ring rust about me tonight, you'll just forgive me. It is 1981, or was it 81? When did you say 1981 is the last time I addressed such an august assembly as this. So unaccustomed as I've become to public speaking, if I am a bit rusty, you'll just forgive me. But before I begin, just to help you to stay with me probably longer than you would, I want to just say a couple of things. The first is this, is that I believe that we're all here to learn. Okay? I really believe that deep down within, that we're all here to learn. And the moment you stop learning is the moment you die. So if you just bear that in mind, it'll help as we go along. Life is the great teacher. And all of our experience of life is different. And the result of that is we come to different conclusions. There's no possible way in which you're all going to, I hope not, I will have missed the mark tonight if you all go out of here agreeing with me. We, those of us on the, quote, platform, we don't agree with each other. Morris's view is rather of the end, or how things are going to end up, is rather pessimistic. For those of you who know him, that goes with his character. Mine's more optimistic because that goes with my character. Phil there, his view of the church and mine are different. He's an Elim minister, and I believe that the church is irrelevant. So, you know, there's got to be a difference between us. Let's pick on Alan. Alan and I disagree fundamentally about creation. He believes that, as he's just expressed so beautifully in that, or before he got to that poem, about how he sees God in creation. I have to admit, these days, despite living in this beautiful place in the New Forest, I find great difficulty seeing God in creation. I don't say that creation isn't beautiful, but when I look at creation as a whole, I tend to feel it's been done by a flawed genius. Rather like the character played in The Rain Man by Dustin Hoffman. I don't know if you saw that. The chap was brilliant at mathematics, but not much else. And those of you who've been looking into the way science is developing at the moment, in fact, there's a book on the shelves at the moment called God is a Mathematician, or the Creator is. And I tend to feel not as Alan does about creation. So we disagree fundamentally, okay? And that's the way it should be. We should be able to question things. The moment you stop questioning is the moment you begin to degenerate into a sect. Anything that stops you questioning is questionable. The thing that sets us above all of creation is that we ask questions. And tonight I don't want you to agree with me, but I do want you to maybe begin to ask one or two questions about where you're at. You'll certainly ask questions about where I'm at by the end. But... So as we're all here to learn, let me just add the second thing into that. You need to beware of experts. That is people like me. I'm an expert in my day job. Okay, my day job is to fit little devices into people's ears so they can hear better. I wish I could do that for you tonight. physically, of course, I mean. But that's the job that I do. And I'm considered an expert. I'm considered to be one of the best in the country, he says humbly. But if only you realized how much guesswork goes into being an expert, you'd be a little bit... If only you knew how a doctor arrived at a diagnosis about your illness, you'd be a little bit more cautious about accepting it as the word of God, as many people do. So we need to be really careful about accepting experts and experts' opinion. When I was in the church, I was an occult expert. Sorry, no, an expert on the occult. I told you I was rusty, didn't I? I was an expert on the occult. All that simply meant is I knew a little bit more than other people did about this dark area. That's all it meant. And so I was classed as an expert. And I really think that today... We have a plague of experts Everybody's an expert in something. They're always dragging them on telly. Usually one expert to knock down what the other expert says. You know, it's called balance. It means you end up believing nothing in the end. But we have these experts. And it's amazing. I think we ought to go back to the days when I was young, which only a few of you here will remember that far back. But in those days, we used to have a healthy skepticism about experts, didn't we? Because they seem to be knowing more and more about less and less. Somebody qualified, got their degree, a BSc, because they studied bees' knees. I'm sure that's vital to the, you know, the future of humanity, that we know how they function. But that's how experts appeared to us in those days. They knew more and more about less and less. And we had a healthy... But today, we accept everything they say. And if you do... It's very difficult to go to a restaurant and order something from the menu because it's bound to be bad for you. All of these food experts, have you realized how over the past years certain things have been really bad and all of a sudden they're really good? It's just because people dress up things in a kind of pseudo-scientific, well, scientific if possible, but pseudo-scientific if not possible, jargon. And we'd accept a scientist's opinion on the king's new clothes, if only it were presented to us properly. And we've had our share of experts, too, in Christianity, haven't we? Unfortunately, the church is dying by degrees, somebody said, and that's true. Too many people just got degrees in this, that, and the other. And the church is dying. It might not appear to be so, because there are millions of people in it. But 10% are leaving the church every year, despite the charismatic renewal. 10%. There's a 10% exodus from the church. That's a hell of a lot of people leaving. I'm part of that exodus myself now, because we can no longer believe these wonderful experts with their dog-eared dogmas and their cold moral absolutes, even when they're wrapped up in something called veritatis splendor. Doesn't that sound great? Do you know what it is? No. The Pope's encyclical... Excuse the hiccup in the middle there. But that's what it's about, this cold moral absolutes where he's defined things. And I tell you, there's nothing splendid about that document. It's cold, and to me it's immoral. And I think we people like me are beginning to shy away from experts as a result of that. So having said that, I'm going to present my Christian CV, curriculum vitae now, so that those of you who don't know who the hell George Stalton is, you'll at least know something about him by the end. I don't know if any of them are here tonight who've asked that question, but at least you'll know something about me. And I'll answer this question, what on earth happened to George Stalton, in the process. But as I present to you my CV and the things I'm going to say later, still bear in mind what I said. I'm going to throw my expert's cap into the ring one more time. But that means you should treat me with skepticism, that you don't believe everything that I say, that you question things that I say. Nobody, but nobody is infallible, not even a certain book. Remember, people wrote the Bible. The Bible didn't create the people. Just want you to remember that, okay? Now that we're free of that, we can get on with my CV. What on earth happened to George Stalton? Well, first of all, I was born into the Church of England. How many of you here were born into the Church of England? Yeah, that's right. You can be born into it, can't you? It's a funny old thing. I was actually born again into it as well. That doesn't mean that I had an experience of God. It very simply means that I accepted biblical truth. That's all you need to be born again. It's called faith, they say, but you're just accepting certain propositions. And that's all that I did. I accepted truth, and I became a born-again person. Luckily for me, excuse this, I'm getting older now and I can't, there's a blur down here, it's called my notes. And if I don't stick to it, I'll never get through by the end of tonight. Luckily for me, it being Anglicanism, I got into the shallow side of evangelicalism. We went on rambles, we put on plays, we even organized dances, you know, sort of where you actually held those days when you actually held each other. And I didn't think this could happen in the... Well, it couldn't happen in some of the churches I've been in since. But we had all of that kind of thing. We used to visit a hospice for the dying. We also went to We used to gather people together on Christmas Day who were alone and do a meal for them. I rose to the dizzy ranks of being a youth leader in that. And I also led a gospel team. I must tell you about this just for 1 second here. But we used to go to Hampstead Heath every Sunday afternoon in the summer. We used to have a collapsible pulpit which we would stand up on. And really, strangely enough, we put it right next to the donkeys. There's a little poem. We're all into poems tonight here, but a little poem I'd like to just recite to you. It reminds me of this time when we sat next to the donkeys. I learnt it at school. It's called The Donkey. When fishes flew and forests walked and figs grew upon thorn, some moment when the moon was blood, then surely I was born with monstrous head and sickening cry and ears like errant wings, the devil's walking parody on all four-footed things, the tattered outlaw of the earth, of ancient crooked will, starve, scourge, deride me, I'm dumb. I keep my secret still, fools, for I also had my hour, one far fierce hour and sweet. There were shouts about my ears and palms before my feet. Maybe it was naive, but we, on those collapsible platforms on Hampstead Heath, we believed too that we were bearing Christ on our backs, just like the donkey was. Anyway, when I moved over from the Anglican Church to the Nonconformists, they felt this gift of preaching was a God-given gift, and that this God-given gift needed to be nurtured, and it needed to be used in a thing they called the ministry. And they pointed me in the direction of the London Bible College. Now, they thought this would be a wonderful greenhouse, but I found it to be a very arid place, very dry, dusty place. Even though they helped me to nurture my love of church history, and indirectly, they were responsible for me being baptized in the Spirit. The authorities were against it. I'll just give you this little piece of advice. If evangelicals are against it, it's worth investigation. There's got to be something in it. And there certainly was something in it for me. I got baptized in the Spirit as a result of this rejection that they had for the baptism of the Spirit. I also managed to fool the... Graham there was at college with me, and we managed to fool the college and the university into giving us little pieces of paper at the end. But you know, a funny thing happened to me at my last days at college, my last week in college. We had somebody from the Billy Graham organization come along. Billy makes regular visits to this country as part of his itinerary, it would appear. And he was making one of his regular visits at the time. And this chap came along to get us to join in the jamboree. And just to show you the kind of person I was in those days, I stood up. And the college was full, and I stood up and I challenged this man, part of Dr. Billy Graham's team. Do you know why? Because Billy Graham had a few liberals on his platform. And being a British Standard Evangelical, BSE for short, thank you. I decided on this doctrine of guilt by association. I think it's a terrible doctrine. And I believe that because Billy Graham had a few liberals on his platform, therefore the whole thing was to be written off. I think that's terrible. Little did I realize that a few years later, I would be part of Dr. Billy Graham's team in a thing called Spree 73, part of the guilt by association rubbed off onto me. Anyway, I passed this college exam and all the rest of it, and I became a minister of the Congregational Church. I was ordained into the Congregational Church in a rebel ceremony. I was the first Congregational minister to be ordained outside of the Congregational denomination. This rebel ceremony was conducted by a chap called Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. You may or may not have heard of the man. But he was my mentor in those early days. I sat at his feet, literally, as he preached his way through Romans. And I imbibed all that he was saying, and as a result, I developed a taste for Calvinism, as a kind of cerebral form of Christianity that makes you feel superior. I got baptized in the Spirit. I dropped it as something that was spiritually deadening. But anyway, I became pastor of this church that was called, the young people called it, there's nobody here tonight, but they called it South Ching Kong. It sounded like a Chinese restaurant, didn't it? It was actually the South Chingford Congregational Church. And they also called me Pastor. They never seemed to remember my name somehow. They always said, you know, hello, Pastor. The young people called me George, but all the older people called me Pastor, which was really strange because the one thing I failed in was this whole area of pastoral duties. I was a really rotten pastor. I was no good at having tea and biscuits, and I was particularly bad, as my wife will testify, at going and visiting people in hospital. It's just as soon as I go into a hospital, I kind of freeze up and I start going into an unreal state myself, you know, so don't expect me to see you when you're ill, you know. And Dorothy knows what to expect. Now, the church, when I went into it, was about half full. And then, because of this great gift of preaching, which I think is now an outmoded way of doing things, that's why this is the last time I will be preaching, this church, which was half full, suddenly became full. It wasn't only because of this wonderful preacher type stuff, but I had become I'd become a pioneer in the charismatic movement. Now, to me, the pioneer of the charismatic movement is a chap called Michael Harper. And I really think it's really odd of God to choose such an uncharismatic man to be the center of such a movement as that. But he was really a doleful old so-and-so. I remember when Dorothy and I, we met him on the weekend that he got baptized in the Holy Spirit. We were then in the Anglican church, and he was taking a parish weekend for us. And unbeknown to us, in his little bedroom, he got filled with the Spirit. And that was that particular weekend that he was there. But Dorothy at that time was getting sick of my Calvinism. She was having it for breakfast, dinner, and tea. You know, I'm like that, unfortunately. If I get hold of something, I give you GBH on the ear roll. And she was really fed up with it. And here was Michael Harper, because he was then John Stott's curate. He was expounding the 39 articles and standing by them and all the rest of it. And Dorothy collared him over breakfast one morning. I don't forget that. And she said, "You believe in the 39 articles, don't you, Michael?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "What about the 17th article? It says that election..." By the way, if you don't know what election is, it's this thing, many are called but few are chosen. And election is about the chosen few. And it appears very few are chosen as far as this particular doctrine goes. It's a very strange doctrine, and Dorothy had every right to revolt against it. But anyway, she turned around to Michael and said, "It says it's of sweet comfort to godly persons, this election." She said, "I don't find it of sweet comfort. Perhaps I'm not a godly person." And Michael just looked at him, looked at her in his doleful way and said, "Perhaps you're not." And carried on. Just carried on eating his cornflakes, you know. I mean, that's the kind of bloke he was. Anyway, as a result of this, I was the first minister to get, first non-conformist minister to get involved in the Fountain Trust Ministers Fraternal. As a result, because Michael is a great organizational man, he made me the secretary, not because I was any good at that sort of thing, but maybe I would draw some non-conformist ministers into this Anglican do. And as a result, the church at Chingford became one of the outposts for the charismatic movement. We used to have all of these speakers through and all the rest of it. And because of having all this input into our little local church, it grew. And also I began to pray for the sick, which I found very thrilling at first, because people got healed. But after a while, I got disillusioned, because only about 1 in 10 got healed. I don't know if you've ever gone into this, but I've looked around, and my batting averages seem to be quite common. And it is about 1 in 10 of the people do get healed. Now, I tell you, I was thrilled for the 10, but I became really depressed for the 90. And I find it even more strange these days when people get what they call slain in the spirit. I don't know, it appears to me as though God's playing skittles, especially when only 1 in 10 still get healed at this stage. It's something that's bewildering to me. Nonetheless, I found another bandwagon to jump on, which was called exorcism or deliverance. And I found that that was much better. The batting averages were now 9 out of 10. And I thought, "Oh, we'll get into that, son. I like success. Unlike Morris, he likes failure. I like success." You see, we're so different. And that's Vive la Défense, you know, that's the way it ought to be. And so I got in. I then became known as somebody who had a deliverance ministry, which I only thought was midwives and postmen had that sort of thing. But anyway, I became known as that, and I became called out at all hours of the day and night, and I got washed out. I got drained out by this ministry. And I was told to stop by a certain group of men. They were called the London Brothers. One of them is sitting here tonight, who shall be nameless, won't he, Maurice? And it's a funny group of people, really. There was Maurice Smith, Gerald Coates, Dave Mansell, John Noble, and myself. Interesting that Dave Mansell popped off to his friend up north. Maurice and I got further and further away from the institutional thing, and Gerald and John have got further and further into it. That's the way we split up. But it was John who drew me in the first place. He befriended me and really was a real friend of mine. I want to say that clear public testimony that he was one of the best friends I ever had, along with a certain person sitting at the back of the room tonight who's mentioned in my book. I won't tell you who he is, Bob. But he was one of the best friends that I ever had. And he was instrumental in me ultimately leaving the Congregational Church. He one day came and he gave me this crumpled up piece of paper and he says, "I believe God wants you to have this." I didn't know God wrote things. Anyway, he gave me this piece of paper, and I was very naive in those days, but this was a smashing little prophecy that he gave me. I was trying to get the church to move on. And on this prophecy it said, you've been standing at the helm of a ship asking the crew to cast off. And I was trying to get the church to move on. And he said, "The crew are very happy to talk about the destination, but they're very frightened of the wind that will take them there." Very, very telling phrase that. He said, "Anyway, just remember that this is just a training ship. That's all it is. It's not going to go anywhere because it has a cement bottom." Nothing more disheartening. I've been pouring my life for 5 years into this thing that I believe was going to set the world alight, and now I found it had a cement bottom. So I felt I had to then leave this particular church for many other reasons. I won't go into them now. They're in the book. And I traveled around the country preaching. When I came back, there were a dozen to 15 people meeting in somebody's front room. And after a while, we grew to, I don't know, about 200-300 people meeting in a church, in a school hall. Is that right, Loxley, about that number? In a church, in a school hall somewhere. The thing just grew. We didn't know we were part of something bigger at that stage. We didn't even know, as the London Brothers, we first of all met in the leprosy mission. It was about 50 holes there. They were worried about the ceilings at the time because we were jumping up and down. And then the next place we came to was here. All Souls Lang and Praise, that's right. Then we came here. Then we went to the London School of Economics, because that holds about 500. Then we went to the Friends Meeting House, which holds 1,000. Then we went to Westminster Central Hall, that was 2,000 something odd. And we ended up in the Albert Hall with 6,000 people. Now, I want to say this categorically. I am thrilled to be a part of that movement, because it was so spontaneous. The only thing we ever advertised for was the Albert Hall. The rest of it just happened quite spontaneously. It just grew, because that was what God... We were just mouthpieces. We weren't nothing clever about us. We were just mouthpieces for what God was saying. Then I ended up being an apostle in the house church movement. No, not a spoon lady, but one of those things that people talk about in the Bible. And incidentally, this word apostle is just used because I had a dozen or so churches under my covering. That's a crafty word, really, for talking about people who are submitting to your authority. And I want to say this equally as clearly as I've said the last. I believe that submission is a sin. An unqualified, unmitigated sin. And I don't believe anybody should be submitting to anybody. That's what happened at Waco in Texas. It's what happened in Jonestown. And I believe it's a dangerous thing that we ought never to have got involved in. Strange enough, The person who authenticated my apostolic ministry was a chap called Brins Jones. I say strangely enough because he and I were at opposite ends of the... Loxley's laughing his head off because he knows this. We were at opposite ends of the spectrum. Bryn was always skeptical about me and I was always skeptical about him. Yet one day in a little tin hut, he prophesied over me. And if you read Restoring the Kingdom, you'll read the actual prophecy. But in his prosaic Pentecostal way, Bryn prophesied over me that I would see why the mountain of the Lord, which was green, would be turned black. In other words, I would see what went wrong. I did. It was this submission, or this sin of submission, but nobody wanted to hear. And as a result, as far as I'm concerned, these freewheeling, anarchic fellowships that we were growing now became claustrophobic churches. They're called new churches now. And that lovely spirit of anarchy and freedom that we had was suddenly lost. And we now had kingdom principles. They probably called something else by now, as I know apostles are no longer called apostles because they're a bit embarrassed as I am about it. And so therefore, the whole thing has been watered down, but it still has that same feel to it. I'm just going to run down this bit now. I did write a couple of things when I was in this... That's part of my CV. You always put down books, what you wrote and all that, you know. I wrote The Occult Mushroom. I forgot about that. Well, it's best to forget about it, quite frankly. But I did write a thing called The Occult Mushroom, but we put that on one side. I'm not interested in that now. I wrote something called The Church in the House. Now, it's an interesting little booklet because it was the summation, it was the précis of something which I said to the Evangelical Alliance. They asked me to speak about The Church in the House. And I think it's interesting from this particular point of view. I think I made the mistake that Paul made. We translated something new in terms of something old. Paul translated Christianity in terms of Judaism. And I believe that was a fundamental flaw. And I translated this new experimental Christianity in terms of the evangelicalism that I'd come from. And I don't believe that's the way to do it. I believe the dead should be left to bury their dead, as somebody said somewhere. The second thing that I wrote that I'm a little bit proud of is something called The Bible Is Not... Actually, it was originally called The Bible Is Not the Word of God, but it was watered down in fullness, called What Is the Word of God? Because after 25 years of preaching that the Bible was the Word of God, I found that it wasn't. And that was a real revelation to me. It came to me like a bolt out of the blue. And I discovered it, not from the writings of liberals. I discarded that when I was at London Bible College. I didn't want anything to do with them. I discovered it from the majestic opening verses of John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt. Or the word there is tabernacled, pitched his tent among us, and we beheld his glory. And for the first time, I separated words from the Word. And now I realize that that was what God was after, that the Word should be made flesh. And this Word could no longer be expressed in words, and it liberated me from confusing the two. And then... Lastly, I wrote a little thing called The Gospel According to St. George. Now, I must explain that for a minute because people think, how dare you, especially knowing your past, call yourself St. George? But I'll tell you where it all happened, actually, at an IVF sort of meeting. I don't know, they're not called IVF now, UCCF meeting. It was a meeting in some university or the other. I think it was in Bristol. I can't remember where now. But they asked me to speak about worship. Now, worship is not really something you can speak about. It's something you have to actually do, isn't it? It's not something you speak about. So I took over this meeting in utter death, double death, really. It was just... I asked them not to say anything before I spoke, but they insisted on doing that, and so it's really dead. And then suddenly I said, it's no good talking about worship. We need to do it. And very gently, we moved from absolute silence into uproarious chaos. People were dancing and jumping around and doing all sorts of things. And this IVF secretary came up to me at the end. It's lovely how we like to find the lowest common denominator. Because he came up to me at the end and he said, "Well, George," he said, "at least we agree on one thing. We're all sinners saved by grace." Charming. I thought, well, I'm blowed if I'm going to agree with you. I said, "I'm not." He was really, he thought, "You cheeky, arrogant so-and-so." He said, "You're not?" I said, no, "I'm a saint." He said, "You're a saint?" "Yeah," I said, "I'm one of those people that Paul wrote to in his letter." You know how evangelicals go for Paul. And I said, "I'm one of the people he wrote to. He always writes to the saints at." And that's when I first used the title St. George to myself. But what I did in this Gospel according to St. George is I decided to express Christ in my own time. Let me just put my stated aim down here. This was my aim, to capture something of the fresh originality and creative diversity of this timeless man. Now, I believe I failed. I don't believe I did that. Because what I did is I clothed him in evangelicalism. And what's more, I grounded him in the first century. You can't do that to somebody who's timeless. And that's where I believe I went dreadfully wrong. Okay, so there you have my CV. I was a youth leader in the Anglican Church. I was a theological student at London Bible College. I was a minister of the Congregational Church in Chingford. I became a pioneer of the charismatic movement. I was one of the London Brothers. I don't know if that's good or bad to put on my CV now. And I became an apostle of the house church movement. Just to finish off this bit, what am I now? I'm a nobody in the no church movement. Can I say it again slowly while that sinks in? I'm a nobody and delighted to be that in the no church movement. That's because I don't believe that Christianity should be a group activity subject to the vagaries of group dynamics. Anybody who knows what group dynamics is, group dynamics always throws up leaders, doesn't it? Any group of us will sit together and suddenly leaders will emerge. And as soon as leaders emerge, they begin to draw lines to protect the people. It's really to protect their own interests. And that's what I feel leaders will always do. And that's why you have to beware of people like me who have been leaders. We always protect our own interests. I did it. I'm not pointing the finger at anybody else. I'm pointing the finger at myself. I believe Christianity should have no boundaries. It should be the leaven within the lump of humanity. What does leaven do? It changes and it transforms. Yeast is only seen to be alive when it's fermenting. And Christianity is only seen to be alive when it's fermenting in humanity and causing a stir. That's why I believe Christianity is basically anarchic. All right, so there you have my CV. That's mainly all the good bits. All the bad bits are in the book. If you want a balanced picture, you'll have to buy the book. By the way, for those of you listening to the tape, the book costs £6.95 plus £1 postage and package from Pendragon Press, 62, P.O. Box 62, Lymington Enhanced. That's here endeth the commercial. But for those of you here tonight, it's cheap, my boy. You can get it for a fiver at the back, and some of them are even signed. You might not want those copies, but they're signed. But I've given you my CV tonight because I want to apply for a job for one night only. I want to be a tour guide of the structure called Christianity. Okay? I've given you my CV. I've been involved for 30 years in this thing called Christianity, so I ought to know something about it. And I've been outside of it for 10 years. So I ought to be able to view it perhaps a little bit more objectively. And I'd like to give you that in a moment.
Running round those worn-out grooves, my well was running dry. Till I looked out one sunny morn, and I kissed that well goodbye. Gospel stickers in the back of the car, the testimonies at the coffee bar, the daily reading and the meditation. A wooden cross hung on a leather thong. In the spirit, out the spirit, heaven knows where. Quiet time, headscarves, hands in the air. Backslide, hair slide, keeping in line. Giving up your job and coming out full time no more. I can't take any more. Bye bye, my friend. I'm heading out the door. I've seen it all. I've heard the fellowship call. I'm reaching the end. I'm climbing over the wall. I'm tired of it all. The Sunday bash down at the meeting hall. The leader's platform and the worship call. The wayward rhythm of a dozen guitars. The praise the lords and hallelujahs. Pogo dancing and hullabaloo. Waiting in silence for the word to come through. The joyous moment as the silence is broke. With a shandaya, behandaya, Bacardi, rum and coke. No more. I can't take any more. Bye bye, my friend. I'm heading out the door. I've seen it all. I've heard the fellowship call. I'm just reaching the end. I'm climbing over the wall. I'm tired of it all. The witness, the wetness, and what's in between. The preaching, the teaching, the conferencing. Those shiny little fishes stuck on jacket lapels. That old time religion that we love so well no more. I can't take any more. Bye bye bye, my friend. I'm heading out the door. I've seen it all. I've heard the fellowship call. Bye-bye, my friend. Oh, yes, I'm climbing over the wall. I'm tired of it all. I'm on my way. Never going back again. I'm tired of it. Oh.
I didn't realize how appropriate that song was until I came back in the door about climbing over the wall. Because now I want to take you into this structure, which is called Christianity. As I say, I'm just going to be a tour guide for one night, and we're going to look at this thing that's been built up over the centuries. And as you come with me, the first thing that you notice is this enormous wall that surrounds everything. This whole thing we call Christianity is surrounded by this wall. Inside the wall is something we call the church, and outside the wall is something we call the world. And if you remember one thing from tonight, I want you just to remember this, because when all that happens you might forget it. Just remember this, that I am longing for a Christianity without walls. It would be the end of evangelism, praise God. Decades of it we had. the 80s was a decade of evangelism. Apparently it wasn't successful because the 90s is now a decade of evangelism. But if you didn't have the walls in the first place, you wouldn't need the evangelism. And I believe the walls really ought to go, because Christianity should not just be confined to Christians. But let's look at these walls a bit more carefully now. And as you look at the walls, the first thing that you will notice is the big, large stones at the bottom. These are the Roman bricks. And these bricks were built around about 400 or so, but they claim to be as old as 2,000 years. In fact, on these bricks, you find two little words, two little letters, S-E, which means Semper Idem. For those of you not literate in the Latin, I was thrown out of my Latin class, in case you think I'm boasting. Semper Idem means always the same. And the people who made these Roman bricks claim that the bricks have always been made like that. For 2,000 years, these bricks have been made this way. They are universal bricks, as far as they're concerned. Their word for universal is Catholic. Above these big Roman bricks, you'll find equally, well, not quite equally as large, but large bricks, which were made only 500 years ago. These bricks were made during a time called the Reformation, and I call them, obviously, Reformation bricks. And instead of having S-E on them, they have the S-S. Nothing to do with Hitler, but it's to do with Sola Scriptura. Another, they always speak in Latin, and that means Scripture only. Because the person who designed these bricks, a monk who we'll come to in a moment, believed that he found the blueprint. The blueprint which was written by the founder. And so all these bricks are built to this blueprint. And right on the top, you'll find some bricks which were built round about 200 years ago, during the time of the Enlightenment and since, where these bricks were made when people began to doubt the blueprint that the monk had discovered. And the bricks are very functional, but there's something missing, a kind of je ne sais quoi, the mystery is definitely missing from these bricks along the top. And so the first thing that you look at when you come to this structure called Christianity is this enormous wall, like the Great Wall of China, surrounding it. But there are doors to this structure. Now, this is where you need a guide, because to go into some doors will cost you a pittance. To go into other doors will cost you an arm and a leg. The simple rule of thumb is the older the door, the cheaper it is to get in. The newer doors can cost you 10% of your income before tax, for starters, as a mark of your commitment. So I suggest, if you've not gone in already, that you come in through the door with me, through one of the older doors, where they'll just pass a little plate around, and even if you haven't got any money, you just bang the plate at the bottom. And you get in. This is where you need a guide, my boy. It's much, much easier to get in. Sorry, I'm trying to be serious in this bit now. As you go into the door, through these doors, the first thing you notice are these immaculately conceived gardens. They're beautifully laid out. The feeling you get as you look at these gardens is something that's all been done decently and in order. There's a sense of ordered peace. Not a piece that rises from within you, but an ordered piece. And the centerpiece of this garden is a magnificent maze. And this maze is called theology. Now, I got trapped in there for years. I was absolutely fascinated by this maze. I was that kind of a person. I got really deeply involved in it. I just plead with you, as I take you on this conducted tour, to resist the temptation to go in there, because we could lose you for years, if not a lifetime. So just quickly slip by, because I want to take you into the building. Because as you go into this building, you have a sense of moving into one of those stately homes. You know, immediately you go in, there's that kind of musty smell, but there's also a sense of history about the place. And as you move into the house, you move into this historical masterpiece where the great and the good begin to look down on you. They always look down on you. People are put on pedestals here, and they're called saints. And I just want to point out a couple of saints on this ground floor. The first saint is a chap called Saint Augustine. Now, Saint Augustine, he dominated the thinking of the church for nearly a millennia, for nearly a thousand years. His thinking dominated the church. And his thinking was based on the philosophy of Plato. It was derived from Plato in the main. He taught the basic goodness of creation, and because of his own personal experiences, the basic badness of man. If I were to have a sense of theology, it would be to reverse those two things. But anyway, we'll leave that as it stands. That's what he believed in. His ethics were basically Greek. The Greeks believed that spirit was pure and matter was gross. And that's what he believed, and that's what the church believed for years and years. And in fact, because they looked at the spirit in that way, when they looked at the body, they also looked down on the body. In fact, St. Augustine felt that sex was all right, so long as you didn't enjoy it. I have a confession to make. I've been trying to find out what he means, what he's meant for the past 40 years, and I haven't discovered it yet. I intend going on to the day I die, but I've no idea how you have sex without enjoying it. But that was one of the things that he put forward. And on another pedestal, you have a chap called St. Thomas Aquinas. Now, around about 1200 and something, he completely changed the thinking of the church from this view of Plato, and he based everything that he said now on the view of Aristotle. See how far the church came in a thousand years. All we moved is from one Greek philosopher to another. And what Thomas Aquinas was saying is that we need to move away, unfortunately, from the mystical. He was anti-mystical and he was pro-science. And he believed that you could prove the existence of God rationally in five ways. Did you see the debate on Channel 4 on the existence of God? Put the lie to that. There's no way. If you can rationalize God, then he's not God. You're talking about something different to me. There's no word that can sum up this imponderable. But that's the way that Thomas Aquinas felt. And his Christianized version of Aristotle became the view of the Roman Catholic Church and is still the view of the Roman Catholic Church today. Now, this ground floor that you've come into was divided in two about 1,000 years ago. One side, the western side, became the Roman Catholic Church, and the eastern side became the Orthodox Church. You have the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, and all the other Orthodoxies, but it was just split in two. Now, I want to take you upstairs just for a moment, and you'll notice the difference immediately you go upstairs. Instead of it being just divided in two, you'll find 1,000 rooms up here. Each of these rooms, I want to tell you, is built to a biblical standard. But they're all built differently, because they're all built to this biblical standard. And just in case you want to pop in one or two of them, there's a password which I need to tell you about. If you knock on the door and they won't let you in, all you have to say is, "I'm born again," and they'll welcome you in straight away. It's the password that is just accepted in this top floor. Now, the person who laid the foundations of this top floor was a monk by the name of Martin Luther. He was the son of a poor miner, and he became a friar around about 1505, something like that. But about 12 years later, on October the 31st, tomorrow's the anniversary of it, Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the monastery in Wittenberg. No, not the monastery, the chapel of the university at Wittenberg. He was protesting against the sale of indulgences. These were pardons for sins issued by the Pope. The church was selling security in this world, security in the next world, to raise some cash in this. It's difficult to understand until you begin to think about the way that the government sold us shares in things which we already owned, like British Telecom, which shall be nameless because one of the people who helped sell us those shares is sitting at the back of the room today, but we won't mention who that is. But that's this kind of thing. The church was selling something which was already theirs, which already belonged to the people, and Luther reacted against this. And the result of which is he was excommunicated 4 years later. It's a wonderful thing being excommunicated because his ideas spread like wildfire throughout the church. In fact, he had to be incarcerated in a castle somewhere to save his life. But in that castle, over those 10 years, he translated the Bible because he believed that the final authority was not to be the Pope, but to be the Bible. And that's why the bricks up there have sola scriptura, because that's really the final authority was to be. Unfortunately, oh, by the way, having said he said that the Bible was the final authority, funny thing was, he didn't like James's epistle. I mean, you know what evangelical view is, if you accept one, you accept the lot. Well, Luther didn't. The actual founder of this whole evangelical thing didn't accept James's epistle. He said it was a right strawy epistle. That's as near as you can get to swearing theologically. He just felt it was out, that you shouldn't have that epistle. But nonetheless, it was included. Luther didn't like it because it went against his doctrine of justification by faith. Incidentally, he discovered this doctrine reading through Morris's best-loved book of the Bible. Oh, Romans, that's right. He read through Romans and discovered justification by faith. Unfortunately, Luther's views were firmed up by a chap called Calvin, who created a cerebral form of Christianity which underpins evangelicalism to this day, unfortunately. And as I say, it's this kind of form of Christianity where you boast about being amongst the elect. But while we're up here, just before we pop down again, I want to point out two interesting characters. This time they're not on pedestals because we don't have pedestals up here. We just have portraits. And the first portrait I want to point you to is the portrait of John Wesley. Now, John Wesley was the son of a manse, and he followed in his father's footsteps and became an Anglican minister. And he had no desire whatsoever, no intention whatsoever of leaving the Anglican Church. But he got mixed up in the evangelical awakening, which was started by a chap called George Whitfield, fantastic preacher. He was more of a prophet than anything else. And he was not very good at holding on to whatever happened in the movement. But along came John Wesley, who was the great organizational man. And all of the gains of that movement were preserved in something called Methodism. I think he would weep if he saw what it was like today. Actually, Wesley was the only evangelical to have a social impact on this country. We talk about affecting the nation. The only person who ever affected the nation was John Wesley. Make no mistake about that. Some people believe he stopped the Reign of Terror coming across the Channel. In other words, stopped the French Revolution coming across the Channel. Because of the great, somebody actually said he was the greatest influence in the 18th century. It's not rubbish, he wasn't anything like that. He was a bit over the top. But he did stop this reign of terror. And it was the only time, as I say, that evangelicalism had an impact in this country. But I want to point you to another character, another picture while we're up here. He didn't have quite the same effect. But he's nonetheless a man after my own heart. A chap called George Fox. We share the same first name, but we probably share a lot more in common. He was a visionary who denounced humbug wherever he saw it, and he preached something called the inner light. You didn't have to go to church or have any rituals or ceremonies. You were guided by the inner light. We've called it, as we've gone along, the inner witness. But it's the same thing that we've discovered by experience. He also discovered by experience. He stopped going to church in 1647. So I have a precedent there. And he journeyed round the country. Incidentally, he incited riots more often than not, and he ended up in prison more often than not. But strangely enough, he must have been a very difficult character to get on with. If you read his journals, you'll begin to see that. But nonetheless, a group grew up around him, a group of sympathetic souls who became known as the Society of Friends, because at the heart of what they believed was that friendship is vital. We believed that in the earlier days, didn't we? We felt that that was to be the main thing. In fact, we used to say that our fellowship was based on life. In other words, our friendship, rather than our doctrine. But somewhere along the line, doctrine came and separated us. Well, the early Quakers believed that. They were called Quakers because they used to quake when the word of God came. Actually, I better not go on to that. Now, we had a fellow in our fellowship. It was really funny. Whenever he had a word from God, he used to, it was frightening to newcomers. He actually, before he said anything, he used to shake like mad. We didn't know. We were absolutely novices. Nobody knew what was the right thing or wrong thing to do. And so before he prophesied, he would shake, and everybody got nervous, and he brought this word out. I'll never forget Dave Mansell, whatever we might feel of him in the since. But Dave Mansell got hold of him and said, "My brother, do stop doing that. That's just nervous energy." And the man never quaked from that moment to this. Isn't it funny? What we think is spiritual sometimes, it's just this chap's nervous habit. Well, maybe that's what the Quakers did. But they used to quake every time they heard the word of God. Incidentally, there was a small group within the Quakers called the Shakers. You have the Quakers and the Shakers. Sounds like a new dance group that's coming along. But the Shakers were a small radical movement, and they used to shout, dance, and speak in tongues. Where have I heard that before? Now, let's go back to the ground floor. It starts to get interesting now. Well, for me anyway. I'm sorry if you don't get interested, but this is a bit I'm really interested in, when we start to go down to the ground floor. Because this time, as you come back to the ground floor, I want you to notice not just the sense of history, but the sense of theatre. Because everybody's dressed up as though they're in some costume drama now. You come in and it's absolutely fantastic as you come here. It's very regal and drama. And all of the costumes were designed by a certain Roman emperor called Constantine. And I'd like to remain here just for a little while. Because the Emperor Constantine, I believe, is a very important figure in Christianity. He laid the foundations of the ground floor. He put them in. So we need to examine what kind of man was this. Let me just briefly tell you about him. The Emperor Diocletian had died. He perpetrated the worst persecution the church had ever known. It's a bit like a Nazi thing, you know. The church went through the worst persecution it probably has ever known, and along comes Constantine and says, "I'm going to stand by you and I'm going to defend you." And they fell right into his arms. But let me tell you why Constantine was converted. Constantine wanted to become emperor, wanted to become Caesar. But he had to take Rome in order to become Caesar. And Maxentius was in charge of Rome at that time, and his army was much bigger than Constantine's. Rome had these fortified walls around it. The Praetorian Guard, who had determined who the Caesars were in charge, and they didn't want anything to do with Constantine. But Constantine decided he was going to march on Rome. And the night before he did, he saw this blazing cross in the sky, kind of Ku Klux Klan style. And it said, "By this sign, conquer." And the next day, a strange thing happened. Maxentius had worked out this brilliant plan. There was only one bridge into Rome called the Milvian Bridge. And he was going to build another bridge alongside. And what he would do is he'd put his armies up along that bridge and pretend to retreat. And as he retreated, and as Constantine's army came onto the bridge, it would just cut the bridge away and it would float downstream. Brilliant, tactically brilliant. Except some idiot cut the bridge when Maxentius' army was on it. And all the wrong army went floating down the river. So Constantine saw that as the divine intervention of the Christian God. And he decided that he was going to back this Christian God. Now, although he decided to do that, he never really changed. He killed the already vanquished emperor of the East. He had his own son killed. And he had his, this is really weird, he had his wife boiled alive in her own bathwater. Now, I can understand getting annoyed with your wife, but that is really taking it a bit too far. But that's what he did. And he never really changed, because just before this time that happened in Milvian Bridge, he was initiated into the cult of Sol Invictus. That's the invincible sun. And he was a devotee of that, as far as we know, to the day he died. He was never initiated into Christianity, i.e. baptized, until his death. I believe that Constantine was just typical of a warrior king in those days. He was superstitious, and he hedged his bets with the gods. As many gods as he could have on his side, the better it would be for him. And so he had the Christian God and he had Sol Invictus. Just a proof that he had Sol Invictus, 10 years after his supposed conversion, he sent out an edict that the great and venerable day of the sun should be the day of rest, i.e. Sunday. Up until that time, Saturday had been the Christian day of rest because they went along with the Jews. But he moved it to Sunday. And here are Christians today defending Sunday, which was just brought in by this Roman emperor. He also changed Christmas Day, by the way. Christmas Day, up until his reign, used to be on the 6th of January. But he moved it forward to December the 25th. You know why? Because December the 21st, the sun god dies. And 3 days later, he's risen again on December the 25th. It was the day that the sun god rose. It was the day that you celebrate as Christmas. Then another interesting thing happened. The divinity of Christ became an issue within this new church that Constantine was now in charge of. And so he gathered together the first world assembly of churches, world council of churches gathered together. It was a strange assembly. There was Jacob the hermit with his goatskin and horde of gnats at one end, and there was Constantine dripping with gold and jewels at the other. And the main issue of contention here was between those who believed that Jesus was the Messiah and just a man, and those who believed that Jesus was more than great, he was divine. But the assembly was split down the middle. And so they turned to guess who for the casting vote? Constantine. They turned to this theological illiterate and said, well, what should we do? Now his father had been made a god when he died. Constantine expected that he would be made a god when he died. So he couldn't see what all the fuss was about. And Jesus was declared to be divine on the whim of an emperor. I used to see a pattern in church history. But the more I study it, the more I see it to be a chapter of accidents. And one of the great accidents, as far as I'm concerned, is Constantine. And the church and the state now became fused. But luckily, there was a reaction against this church-state monstrosity called the flight into the desert, where they got as far away as they could from the Roman Empire. They went into Egypt, and they built monasteries there just to get away from it all. And they actually built a monastery at a place near Nag Hammadi. And here, in 1945, some documents were discovered that were buried during that century. These documents changed or revolutionized my view of the early Jesus movement. So let me take you now beneath this floor that the Roman emperor built, okay? We're getting near to the foundations now, but as you go down under this floor, you go into the wine cellars. And as you go into the wine cellars, you'll notice that there are two different kinds of wine. There's the wine of the logical thinkers and the wine of the lateral thinkers. The wine of the logical thinkers is produced by people who felt it's best to stick with what you already know. And so they grafted their grapes, their vine, onto the Jewish stock. And the one thing about that is they produced wine which was always consistent. It always tasted the same because it was grafted onto this Jewish stock and it came from that and it lived there. But the lateral thinkers, they were a real funny lot. But I have to admit, I like them. They just got hold of this vine and they stuck it onto anything they thought it would grow onto. And they kept sticking it on everywhere. The result is the grapes that they produce, sometimes they produce god-awful plonk. It really was revolting stuff. But other times they produce some vintage champagne, Dom Perignon type champagne. But unfortunately, you never knew what you were going to get. And so the lateral thinkers were pushed to one side and the logical thinkers came to preeminence. Among the lateral thinkers, the heretical wine, was a heretic by the name of Valentinus. I find him one of the most fascinating characters in early church history. He never looked at himself as a heretic. He had schools in Egypt, Cyprus, and in Rome. He nearly became the Bishop of Rome. often wonder what would have happened to church history if he'd become the Bishop of Rome. But he almost made it. His views were knocked by a chap called Irenaeus when he wrote Against Heresy. By the way, when he wrote Against Heresy, he wrote 5 volumes against heresy. It's a bit OTT, isn't it, really? Not just a little tract about it. 5 volumes, but that's how serious this heresy was treated in the early days. Although some of the early church fathers, like Origen and Clement of Alexandria, they took on these Gnostic views and developed them. And let me tell you this. That's what a Gnostic expected you to do. He expected you to take his views and to develop them. He was like an artist teaching you to paint. And once you'd learned to paint, he wanted you to create your own truth. And that's what the Gnostics felt. That's why you never got agreement amongst them. They did agree in 1 or 2 basic things, because like modern psychiatrists, they felt that self-knowledge was vital. Because if you don't know things about yourself, you get driven by impulses that you don't know about. So it's vital to know about yourself. Also, like modern psychiatrists, they believed that the psyche contained within it the potential for liberation or destruction. Let me read you something from one of the Gnostic Gospels. It's called the Gospel of Thomas. If you bring forth what is within you will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you will destroy you. Sounds like a Zen cone, doesn't it? In fact, somebody once described Gnosticism as the Zen of the Western world, and I think it is. Because to the Gnostic, light was the central principle. They believed that divine light had been trapped in matter. And the main thing that matter had to do was to return to its source. That was the dynamic of this Gnostic thought. Humanity, in the main, didn't know where it had come from and didn't care. It's like we're all suffering from a cosmic amnesia. But when we begin to remember, when we begin to search within ourselves, we begin to know. That's what the word gnosis means. And we begin to discover where we've come from, where we are, and where we're going to. But one of the things about Gnosticism, I couldn't possibly begin to explain it to you today. In fact, theologians have tried, or scholars have tried to define Gnosticism, but nobody can ever define it clearly. And it will always remain creedless as a result. But reading the Gnostic Gospels has convinced me that there never was a golden age of Christianity. It always contained a diverse range of views. And no single structure can ever claim to be Christianity. It's impossible. Historically, it's not possible, because historically, it's always been diverse. You think we've got problems with about 1,000 different Protestant sects at this moment? They had much the similar thing in the early church. Now, I want to just look at the wine of orthodoxy for a moment. And here things begin to get interesting. Remember that the first Christians were Jews. They never left the temple. They worshipped in the temple. They were followers of the Jewish law. In fact, if you were to sum up what these early Christians felt, it would be guilty before the law, because they were Jews. They believed in the Torah. They believed that the law was final. And they saw Jesus as the Messiah. They never saw him as divine, because to the Jew, he believes that God is one. Adonai Echad, God is one. There's no difference. And so there cannot be another God, which is what they viewed Paul as saying. They viewed Paul as a heretic, because Paul denied this whole teaching of the law. And also because Paul was saying that Jesus was divine. These Jewish Christians, by the way, were very, very strong. They were like, have you seen these Islamic fundamentalists on television? Really going bananas and banging their head until they bleed. That's the kind of fanaticism there was amongst these early Jewish Christians. In fact, Peter was so frightened of them that at one stage with Paul, he was eating with the Gentiles. And as he was eating with the Gentiles, certain men came down from Jerusalem, and Peter immediately went away from them. That's how strong they were. These people had come down from Jerusalem to tell Paul he had to toe the line about circumcision. But Paul didn't do that. And so they sent him into exile in Tarsus. But Paul, being the character that he was, he couldn't keep his mouth shut. And he began to preach in Tarsus. Interesting thing is that the believers were first called Christians where? Not in Jerusalem, because you couldn't differentiate them from a Jewish sect there. They were first called Christians in Antioch. That's the place where they first were called Christians, because that's where Paul began his preaching. Now, let's have a look at Paul just for a moment. The earliest record we have of Christianity comes from Paul. About 50 AD, he began to write his epistles. He wrote Romans, which Morris will be glad about. He wrote 1 and 2 Corinthians, and he wrote Galatians, but we're not sure about the rest. We're particularly not sure about Hebrews and what are called the pastoral epistles. You know, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus were clearly not written by Paul. And yet the proof text for believing that the Bible is the inspired word of God is what? 2 Timothy 3:16. All scripture is given by inspiration of God. And that was written by somebody who claimed to be Paul and wasn't, namely a liar. Now, Christian theologies, sorry about that, you can come back to me later. Christian theology was first put into a logical system. Oh, that's good. It warms it up when people disagree. Or warms me up, anyway. Christian theology was first put into a logical system by the Apostle Paul. Interesting thing about him is he never quoted in his epistles any of the stories of Jesus that you read in the Gospels. There are no quotations about what Jesus said, only the sayings of Jesus in his epistles. He glories in the fact that his gospel is different to anybody else's. Listen to what he says in Galatians. I did not take it over from any man. No man taught it to me. I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. That's his boast. Many others were making the same claim. But Paul's rose somehow to the top of the pile, again, probably by accident. Probably he was the first person to write anything down. So orthodox heresy, or orthodox Christianity. That's right. Sorry, I'm getting serious here now, but I haven't got the time to joke around. This is my last appeal that I'm making. Orthodox Christianity started out as a heresy within the framework of Judaism. And even though Paul goes on to develop his own idiosyncratic views, they become the norm. As I say, just by an accident of history. Listen to what one of the early church fathers says here. It's very rare that I agree with them, but this is a bishop called Hilary in the 4th century. The error of others have caused us to err by daring to embody in human terms truths which ought to be hidden in the silent veneration of the heart. I.e., we're back to the mysterious again. Now, although Paul laid the foundations because he was the first one to write, there are four cornerstones. As well as the foundation, you have four cornerstones. They're called four gospels. The unfortunate thing about it is those four gospels do not agree. Throughout the last century, most people tried to write what's called a harmony of the gospels, but it's impossible to do so. The roots vary, the sayings vary. You cannot harmonize the Gospels. The first three have something in common because they have a common source. This Mark is the source of Luke and Matthew and a thing called Q, but I won't confuse you with that now. But let me quote you from the Greek here of Luke's Gospel. Since many have taken in hand to draw up a narrative, not just two or three of us, since many have taken to draw up a narrative, it seemed good to me also, having investigated from their source all things accurately. Now, this claim for accuracy in the Gospels doesn't really stand up, especially Luke's claim, because it's not accurate. He says that Jesus was born when Herod was king and Quirinius was governor of Syria. Herod died long before Quirinius became governor of Syria. He said a decree went out that all the world should be taxed under Caesar Augustus. It never happened. And even if there was a decree from Caesar Augustus, Roman censuses cared nothing for remote genealogies, and they would not have forced Joseph to go all the way to Bethlehem. And if Joseph were forced to go all the way to Bethlehem, he would not have to take his terminally pregnant wife. It's like most census is now, the head of the household was quite sufficient in order to go and fill in the census. Which brings us to the question of the virgin birth. It's a very, very interesting question, because the person who wanted to prove Jesus' divinity more than anybody else was Paul. Read his epistles, you'll not find any mention of the virgin birth. The most mystical of the Gospels, John's Gospel, doesn't mention the virgin birth. The source Gospel, Mark's Gospel, doesn't mention the virgin birth. And the two Gospels that do, the virgin birth tends to stand out like a sore thumb. Ironically, they trace the birth of Jesus, the genealogy of Jesus, through the male line. As far as I understand it, their input was zero. And yet it's traced through the male line. And they don't even get Joseph's father right. In one gospel he's called Heli, and the other he's called Jacob. And Matthew quotes, "A virgin shall conceive," from Isaiah 7:14. It doesn't say a virgin shall conceive. In Isaiah 7:14 it says, "A young woman shall conceive." There are many Jews today expecting the Messiah. Challenge them. Find out any one of them that's expecting a virgin to conceive. It's not true. These things need to be looked at. Incidentally, you might be worried about me at this moment. I just want to say that my gospel is, I believe that Jesus lived, died, and rose again. Just in case you put me along with the Bishop of whatever his name is. Durham, thank you. I still believe that if he didn't rise again, he'd have to do something pretty damn near it to cause the fuss that he did. If you take away the resurrection, you've got to put something in its place that's equally as dramatic, and I can't think of anything more dramatic. But it still leaves room to question this particular issue. But let's look at my favorite gospel. We're getting near to the end now. Let's look at my favorite gospel, which is the gospel of John. I really think that is the historically it's the most valuable gospel, because here we have an eyewitness. He said, "And the Word became flesh and tabernacled amongst us, and we beheld his glory." Here's somebody who actually saw it. "In him was life, and the life was the light of men." Here's an eyewitness. And when he speaks about the disciple whom Jesus loved, he's obviously speaking about himself. But he's obviously not one of the 12 either. This is not some illiterate fisherman. This is some literate person, probably a priest of some sort. But his gospel is so different. Have you noticed that? His gospel is so different to the other three. Even Morris is shaking his head. I mean, he doesn't go in for these sort of things. But it is so different, isn't it? Exactly. It's so mystical. In fact, it was so mystical and so Gnostic that it nearly got left out. Because if you were to sum up Gnosticism in one phrase, it's found in John 8:32. "You shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free." That's what a Gnostic was saying all the time. He wouldn't tell you what the truth was, but he would say, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And strangely enough, this mystical gospel is also the most accurate gospel. Let me give you one quick example of that. It says in John chapter 5, that there was a pool called Bethesda in Jerusalem by the sheep market, which had five porticos. You don't know what porticos are. They're columns with a roof on the top. But why should one pool have five porticos? I mean, it's ridiculous. But in 1950, they excavated the site right there, and they found that there were two pools side by side, each of them having a portico either side. That's four, and one in the middle. And this strange anomaly shows that here, this mystical though he was, is an accurate gospel. But I have to say that despite that, John's gospel has an awful lot of padding in it. If you look at John chapter 14 at the end, Jesus says, "Let us arise and go hence," at the Passover, at the Last Supper. But he goes on speaking for another three chapters. Somebody obviously added something there. You see, the problem in the New Testament is knowing exactly what Jesus said. There is no way you can know it except by the witness of your own spirit. That's the only ultimate way that you know that that is what Jesus said, because historically there is no way. The first 100 years of the life of the Gospels, it's just, they're being written and rewritten. We don't know what was left in, we don't know what was put in, left out, we don't know what was put in. It's just a complete shambles. In fact, I believe one of the reasons why Jesus came at this particular time is because the oral tradition was more important than the written. These Gospels that we now revere were not revered when they were first written. They revered the oral tradition. They revered the word of mouth, because there was something living about that. The early Christians were not textual fundamentalists. They were people of faith. And they were more concerned about this living Jesus. You see, we're so concerned about facts. One little name-dropping thing here. I remember talking to Malcolm Muggeridge about facts, this old journalist, you know, who spent his life digging out the facts, and he said to me, "There are no such things as facts, dear boy." He said, we all see life as a great drama, and we all view it from our own perspective, and that's true. We would disagree, some of us that were involved in this house church movement, about the facts of it, because we all view it from our own standpoint. Matthew viewed Jesus from a Jewish standpoint. Mark viewed Jesus from a charismatic standpoint. Luke viewed Jesus from a universal standpoint. John viewed Jesus, as we've said, from a mystical standpoint. Now, the Gospels all contain the genuine convictions of the writers, but they were creative with the truth. And there's nothing wrong with that. Their patchwork of views often tell us more about the authors than they do about their subject. They were niche marketing Jesus. And remember that these men were affected both by their culture, which was Jewish, their environment, which was Jewish, and their culture, which was Greek. And rightly so too. Now, at this point, I began to wonder, well, why on earth wasn't Jesus born now? It would be so much easier, wouldn't it? Everything would be caught on television. Every word that he said would be replayed endlessly. Action replays of Jesus. You'd catch, Richard Morris has often wanted to do, and so have I, really. I'd like to catch the tone of his voice. Whether there was just a bit of hint of laughter sometimes, and whether other times there was that sense of being told off. You don't know unless you hear the tone of his voice. You'd catch the tone of his voice. You'd catch the look on his face. Why didn't he come now? It's, I believe, because he never, ever wanted to be trapped in time. If he came now, he would be trapped in our particular time warp. He would be frozen within the prejudices of our age and within our culture. Everything that we ever say about Jesus is subjective, and I want to just remind you about this. Jesus never wrote a book. It would have saved all the fuss if he did, wouldn't it? I wouldn't have to stand up and say all this tonight, and you'd just say, well, he said it. It's there, it's written. He never wrote a book. He never asked anybody to write a book. None of the 12 that were nearest to him wrote a book, as far as we know. Jesus never anticipated the New Testament. In fact, the only time that Jesus ever wrote anything, do you know when that was? When there was a woman caught in adultery. Caught in the very act, it says, probably not much on. Stepped down, and he wrote in the sand. But that didn't last for long, did it? I'm finishing. Right. Let's finish on this. Jesus was all things to all men. He's the hero of a thousand. He's the hero of a thousand faces. And I want to tell you this: there are as many ways of coming to Christ as there are people. There never was a moment in time when the experience of Jesus was the norm. There's nothing special about this first century encounter with Jesus. There is something of an eternal now about Jesus. You cannot trap him in time. And I think all of this trapping in time ought to be, if you want that kind of certainty, that's fine by me. But there are some of us now that are beginning to shed our arrogant ignorance for a knowledgeable uncertainty. If you want to tend the gardens of orthodoxy, that's fine. We want to get involved with the wildflowers of heresy. But for God's sake, let's take this wall down. Christianity is not just for Christians. At this moment in time, there's a spiritual renaissance blossoming on the other side of the wall, in case you didn't know about it. Evangelicals don't like it. Again, a sign that there may be something in it. New Age. Let's bring that horrible word up now. New Age is one of the visible flowers of this springtime, and it looks as wacky as flower power did. Those of us who lived through flower power, you remember how nutty the whole thing looked? With your flares and your flowered shirts. Deja vu. But just remember this. Please remember this. The swinging 60s produced the charismatic movement. The two things came out of the same seedbed. And I believe the same thing is happening again. I believe that right now there are people that are in seekers that are looking. They're revolted by the materialism of the 80s, and they're looking for an 80s, and they're looking for another dimension. They're more interested in mouth-watering mysteries than they are in dog-eared dogmas, because humanity needs to cope with change. And people are looking for a new way. And the simplistic morality or moral absolutes of a bygone age are no match to this age of complexity that we're about to go in. Do you know that by the end of this century we'll be able to redesign all living things because of the genetic revolution that's taking place? Do you know that right now human genes are in sheep and goats? A morality that separates sheep and goats isn't going to be much help in a new age that's coming. I'm stopping now. Let me just say this. The challenge to us is to become part of it. The last time I spoke, I said God is giving us to the world. I didn't realize what I was saying. I've now experienced that. And I believe that God is giving us to the world to become part of this. And it's only those who are spirit-filled, I feel, that can rise to it. Because if you live by your spirit, you're not challenged by the strong opinions of other people. If you live from your mind, you'll be challenged all the way along the line. But if you live from your spirit, you can live in such a world where you can face challenge. Change is the essence of life. The moment you cease to change is the moment you die. In him was life. I'm come that you might have life, not that you might have meetings. I think this is the way we ought to do it, once every 12 years. I'm come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly. And when you have when you meet this, you always meet God as you move towards life. I've tried to meet him moving away from it, and I proved you don't. It's only as you move into life that you meet him. And I believe that the whole of this new age that we're moving into is an age when we should be moving towards the truth. I don't mean truth that can be explained. Can I have my book just for a minute? Who's got my book? Can I just read to you what I... Oh, thank you. Can I just read to you as I finish what I believe truth to be? It's only a page. And then I'll let you go. Is it right? This is good. Oh, all the rest of it's been terrible, but this is good. Right, listen. Listen to this. Morris endorsed. This is the introduction. We're all seekers, finders, and seekers still. Searching for the truth has dominated my adult life. Once I was so convinced I'd found it, I preached it to thousands. Now I'm in the hunt again, and it's exciting. So what is truth? Ironically, this question is raised in the oldest fragment we have in the New Testament. This scrap of parchment contains just a couple of verses. One of them has Pilate's searching question on it. To me, truth is a strong, beautiful woman. She's always dressed immaculately in the latest facts. Many look no further. How sad to imagine that you have discovered the truth merely by unearthing cold, hard facts. Facts need to be evaluated. Lawyers manipulate them. Politicians play with them. Truth lies beyond the fabric of facts. Once you get beneath her dress, you find her cultural underwear. Each culture readily accepts certain things while rejecting whatever does not fit their cozy customs. No matter how seductive, we need to go beyond this homespun chastity belt. When you get to see the naked truth, you can simply remain an observer. It's called the scientific approach. No one will blame you for remaining a voyeur, for truth in all her naked splendor is truly magnificent. However, some physicists are beginning to see that we cannot be that objective. What we see as physical reality, they say, is merely our interpretation of it. Reality is what each of us decides it is. The word that Pilate used for truth means not only a knowledge of what is true, but an experience of what is real. Truth is a warm, living body that we can experience. Books can only take you so far. The holy books of the world's religions are like different parts of a sex manual, because the founder of their religion encountered truth in a certain position. The followers claim it's the only way. Fundamentalists always seem to opt for the missionary position. You can try all the different techniques, but you end up with just a momentary thrill. The secret is learning to ride the wave of ecstasy. Truth responds to love. She must be given time to reveal her secrets, not raped. Knowing truth involves intimacy. Adam knew Eve and she conceived. For too long, we've separated knowing from being. When you know something in the depth of your being, it sets you free. Free to be, free to become, free to beget. A love affair with the truth always produces something divinely human. The Word is made flesh. Whatever is born is unique to you. This book contains what is unique to me. Very good. Thank you.